Please join me in the responsive invocation that's printed in your order of service. We gather to seek, to find, and to share the promise of honest religion. And so it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. Vulnerability more powerful than strength.
And peace that can pass all understanding.
It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our lives and the center of our service, we take time to slow down and quiet down through lighting of candles, quiet music, prayer, and silence. We seek rest in our own centers. You may use these moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in a spirit of prayer. Let us find a spiritual North Star to steer by when we're torn between life's overrated pleasures and its underrated treasures. We want to feel the difference between being opportunistic and being authentic, and learn how we can better choose the one that gives us more and better life. Let us find the determination not to do what we should not do, the courage to do what we should do, and that elusive wisdom that lets us tell the difference. How often we chase after things we don't need, like dogs chase cars, not knowing what good they do us if we caught them. Can we learn to yearn for what we need rather than what we merely want? And as for our lives, if they can't be as long as we would like, can they be as rich and rewarding as we would like? These are just some of the questions we feel along life's path on this day and on many days. We offer them up to speak them out loud in the sincere hope that the person who hears them will be us. Amen. There's something exhilarating about singing that song. Silly, but exhilarating. There's also something exhilarating about being present when high ideals and aspirations are discussed, even if all we plan to do is listen. We consult experts in diet, exercise, ecology, finances, and a few dozen other areas, all important, each with some really gifted and motivated people available to pass on their inspiring visions and enthusiasm to us. And it feels well worth the money we've spent. In the meantime, we stay overweight, out of shape, eating poorly, handling our finances poorly, and all the rest of it. Still, it's inspiring. Hearing about gifted religious visionaries and prophets is a lot like this. This is the third in a series of three sermons on the very gifted and visionary early 19th century thinkers who helped define Unitarianism as a separate religion in America, a religion that was derived from, but distinct from, liberal Christianity. All three men were in their 30s when they delivered the sermons, that Unitarian students are still required to read. William Ellery Channing was 38 when he delivered the sermon called Unitarian Christianity in 1819, back when Unitarian Christianity was still almost completely supernatural. Ralph Waldo Emerson was 35 when he gave his famous address at the Harvard Divinity School, which was the last time he was invited to speak there for 30 years. You're picking up a pattern here. And the third minister is the one I want to talk about today, Theodore Parker, who was only 31 when he delivered a sermon called The Transient and the Permanent in Christianity in 1841. I have to say that Parker is my favorite of the three of them, and he was from the first time I read their sermons almost 30 years ago. Theodore Parker was an almost mythic person, I think almost impossible actually to identify with. He was born the 11th child of a poor farmer. He grew up very poor. He was mostly self-educated. Then he wound up graduating from Harvard Divinity School. By the time he entered the ministry, he could read 20 languages. After he died at the age of 49 of tuberculosis, it was discovered that his library was the largest personal library in America, with about 50,000 volumes. His biographer said that Parker wrote notes in the margins of almost all of them. If he actually read them all, I did the math, that would be reading almost three books a day from the minute he was born. We know that he did start doing very serious and very heavy reading by the age of 10. At his peak, he preached to around 3,000 people on Sunday, the largest audience in America, and he did it without a microphone. His sermons routinely lasted over an hour, were thoroughly researched, like a master's degree thesis, and brilliantly written. Besides being the most powerful and combative voice of liberal religion in America, far more combative than either Channing or Emerson, he was ferociously active on behalf of women's rights, prison reform, and especially anti-slavery causes. He did that in the 1840s and 1850s, which was well before the abolition of slavery was a popular cause that Unitarians even wanted to touch. That's because many of the wealthy Unitarians made a lot of money from the business of slavery, and partly because slavery was considered a rude subject, not suited to high-class cocktail hours. They looked to their ministers for comfort, not courage. Parker was part of the Underground Railroad that helped slaves escape from the South. One story about him that shows both his courage and his ferocity is about the time that he performed a wedding ceremony for two escaped slaves. This was illegal, of course. Holding a Bible in one hand and a pistol in the other to shoot anyone who tried to stop him. Martin Luther King once said, "We begin to die the day we become silent about the things that matter." As far as I can tell, Parker never had one of those days in his life. He was uninhibited in his writings about dishonest religion, as about everything else. The things he said in just this one sermon defined the theological debates in America for at least the next generation, and are still powerful and still being discussed by the best students at the best seminaries who are preparing for the Unitarian ministry. But I want you to hear his words, because he was very good with words. So imagine, if you can, sitting in a Unitarian church on May 19th, 1841. Now, you're there for the ordination of a young minister who is really not a liberal, a young minister who is really more at the right wing of the Unitarians, which makes this sermon even more shocking. This was at a time when American Christianity, including Unitarianism, was still quite supernatural, and often so conservative that it would feel to us a lot like today's right-wing Christianity. So imagine hearing some of these words in that context, spoken by a brilliant and quite fiery 31-year-old preacher. While true religion is always the same thing, in each century and every land, the Christianity of the people, which is the religion that's actually accepted and lived out, has never been the same thing in any two centuries or lands. Anyone who traces the history of what is called Christianity will see that nothing changes more from age to age than the doctrines taught as Christian and insisted on as essential to Christianity and personal salvation. What is falsehood in one area passes for truth in another. The heresy of one age is the orthodox belief and infallible rule of the next. The stream of Christianity as men receive it has caught a stain from every soil it has filtered through, so that now it's not the pure water from the well of life which is offered to our lips, but streams troubled and polluted with a lot of dirt. Since our various theologies are so transient, why do we need to accept the teachings of men as though they were the Word of God? Almost every sect that's ever been, makes Christianity rest on the personal authority of Jesus rather than the immutable truth of the things he said. It's hard to see why the great truths of Christianity should rest on the personal authority of Jesus any more than the axioms of geometry rest on the personal authority of Euclid or Archimedes. The authority of Jesus, as of all teachers, must rest on the truth of his words. Wasn't Jesus our brother, the Son of Man, as we are, the Son of God, like ourselves? His excellence, wasn't it human excellence? His wisdom, love, piety, sweet and celestial as they were, are they not what we also may attain? In him, as in a mirror, we may see the image of God. Viewed in this way, how beautiful the life of Jesus is. God's word will not change, for that word is truth. From this, Jesus subtracted nothing. To this, he added nothing. Christianity is a simple thing. It's very simple. It is absolute, pure morality. Absolute, pure religion. The love of man, the love of God. Real religion gives men new life. Now, 167 years later, many of these words would still send most believers into fits of apoplexy. For Parker, the only sanction that religion requires is, as he said, the voice of God in your heart, the perpetual presence of him who made us, Christ and the Father abiding within us. This is the permanent religious core of genuine Christianity for Parker. All the rest is transient and dispensable. That includes all the creeds, all the rituals, all the orthodoxies, all the customs. As you can hear, though Parker oddly seemed not to hear it, the logical implications of what he's saying pulverize the intellectual foundations of Christianity, theism, and all religions, reducing them to little more than ways of talking about high morals and ideals, which of course can be done without using any religious language at all. Even if his ministerial colleagues, and by the way, they don't look good in this story, just as they didn't look good in the stories of Ralph Waldo Emerson and William Ellery Channing. But to give them a little credit, even if his colleagues couldn't articulate it, they must have felt the force of this unwelcome earthquake in the foundations of their comfortable faith. And Unitarianism at that time was a very comfortable faith among the wealthy in and around Boston. They reacted to his sermon by cutting him off from the privileges of ministerial fellowship. Nearly all of the Boston area ministers refused to exchange pulpits with him, and some refused to speak to him. The Unitarian ministers told Parker that it was his moral duty to resign from the Unitarian Association because of his beliefs. The Creedless Unitarian Association. Parker was both smart and shrewd enough to refuse. He said no, they would have to expel him as a heretic. Cornered, they backed down, pretty much with their tail between their legs. And so, as one historian puts it, the first Unitarian heresy trial was over. Parker believed that the time had come to sweep away all religious authorities except the authority of reason and spiritual intuition. True Christianity, he said, is not about the death and divinity of Christ. It's about the death of sin and life of holy goodness in our heart. Each man must be his own Christ, or he is no Christian, he said. He defined real Christianity simply as being good and doing good, not needing any miracles or supernaturalism, or for that matter, creeds, churches, or priests. This drew complete outrage from nearly all clergy, including the Unitarians. At first, Parker hoped that and believed that American Unitarianism could become America's best religious hope. But within a few years, he decided that it was so unwilling to see or to think that there was no hope at all for it. It's a little confusing that he continued to insist on calling himself a Unitarian, especially since the leading Unitarian ministers wouldn't claim him, wouldn't swap pulpits with him or speak to him, and wanted him to resign. But Unitarianism was a very complex thing in the Boston of his day. It was a religion of the upper class, associated with intelligent, educated, and sophisticated people. And Parker wasn't willing to let go of that identity, which he had worked so hard to earn. He'd grown up as a very poor boy, worked hard, married a very wealthy woman. They moved in those upper-class social circles, although Parker's anti-slavery work really ended their welcome there, too. I think that giving up the Unitarian label would have felt to him like losing that social and personal identity that he'd earned. He also wanted the rest of the Unitarians, this is his idealism operating, he wanted the rest of the Unitarians to grow into the larger and the more honest understandings of religion that he could see so clearly. He said the Unitarians were standing still and becoming more and more narrow and bigoted from year to year. There's little scholarship and less philosophical thinking among the Unitarians, he wrote. Some of them engage in the great moral movements of the day, such as the anti-slavery movement, but the sect itself is opposed to all intellectual reforms. His opponents, as you can hear, this would be a very hard man to argue with. And his opponents didn't know how to either. And so they used his notorious radical social activities to label and to smear him, partly so they wouldn't have to answer his powerful critiques of their unexamined but comfortable religion. So Theodore Parker lived the powerful contradiction of preaching to the largest crowd in America while being deeply alienated from the Unitarians and spurned as unbearable by most respectable high-class socialites. No matter how fierce he was in public, and he was fierce, he grieved his whole adult life in private over the continual attacks and rejection from the people and the denomination to whom he believed he offered valuable but much unwanted help. In January of 1859, he was told that he was dying of tuberculosis. It did not diminish his spirit, and one of the most inspiring things he ever wrote, he wrote in his journal after receiving this death sentence, "I'm ready to die, nothing to fear. When I see the inevitable, I fall in love with her." I've had friends tell me how thoroughly Buddhist that is, and it is. Since his wife had money, they could leave Massachusetts, and they did, so that he could spend his last year traveling Europe, settling in Rome. He would die in Italy in 1860, not long before his 50th birthday. A few months before he died, he wrote another memorable line to a friend. "I have had great powers," he said, "and have only half used them." All three of the great Unitarian preachers of the early 19th century, I think, were absolutely brilliant men who stood head and shoulders above almost everyone around them, and they would today too. They would any time they lived. Though whether any of them can really be called Unitarian in any modern sense, I think is a very different matter. William Ellery Channing, who named Unitarian Christianity, refused to join the Unitarian Association when it began in 1825. He feared that it was just dumbed down religion and lure people to the lowest common denominator, where they wouldn't think for themselves but would look for some sort of creeds or principles to recite. To put this in modern terms, what Channing feared was that the Unitarian Association would grow into a narcissistic cult, where people were taught to worship the kinds of things that their kind of people believed, that's the narcissism, and were told coming in that that's what people in that group believed. That's the cult. His fears were well-founded. Ralph Waldo Emerson, easily the most famous of the three, called Unitarianism corpse cold. And he was not considered a Unitarian by any of the leading ministers of his day. He thought Unitarianism had become smug, shallow, and irrelevant. And Theodore Parker, I think the most brilliant of them all, was blacklisted from all the Unitarian pulpits in Boston because of his liberal thinking, was told he should resign from the Unitarian Association, and told that he wasn't a real Unitarian. One member of the church where he delivered his most famous sermon even said that he would rather see every Unitarian church burned to the ground than to see Parker's beliefs preached from even one pulpit. The important truth is that these three men stood out against the background of Unitarians and Christians of their day because the overwhelming majority of Unitarian ministers of their day were not memorable. And their beliefs and actions are hard, even today, to look back on with much admiration when we hear these stories. These three men were prophets of a higher truth than almost any Unitarians would or could see, though they continue to inspire new Unitarian ministers who are still required to read them. Of all the voices going around during their lives, only their three are still being read by Unitarian ministers. We don't look back on any of the other voices in the arguments as things that we would be proud to read. That's a powerful comment on the difference between these three and their background. They weren't serving Unitarianism, and they were all pretty clear about that. They were serving what Parker finally labeled, as the permanent in religion. True religion, absolute religion, honest religion. And throughout history, those voices have always been a very small minority in every religion. No worse in the Unitarians than in any other religion. We listen to serious religious thinkers, I think, the way that orchestras listen to the concert A that is played before all rehearsals and concerts for them to tune to. The orchestras are better at tuning to it than we often are. We listen to them the same way we listen to other experts and motivational speakers in so many other areas, diet, exercise, ecology, finance, and the rest of them. We may not be motivated enough or courageous enough to follow them down the demanding path of getting into our best spiritual shape, but we're at least serious enough to listen. There haven't been many thinkers in any religion who wanted to move beyond the easy comfort of fitting in with like-minded people. It's really what we come to church for. I think that's why we're actually happier with these outspoken types after they've died, when we can treat them reverently rather than seriously. But if these prophets, including Theodore Parker, are right, then getting in spiritual shape really is as easy and as hard as actually thinking about who we are and why we are here, about what is most worth believing and doing. This seems to be what they've all said in their many different ways, all the prophets. Confucius, Lao Tzu, the Buddha, the biblical prophets, Jesus, Muhammad, all the way up to the relatively minor but still stirring people like Channing, Emerson, and Parker. These were people at the Olympic level of spiritual development, no matter how out of shape they may have been in other ways. None of them was in very good financial shape, for instance, and I don't think any of them lifted weights. They were both empowering and troubling people. They didn't exist to tell us that, by golly, we're special, or that this business of authenticity is easy. You can do it in 10 steps and lose 17 pounds at the same time. They said the road was narrow and very few ever wanted to take it. even though it was open to all. They said salvation was free, but it wasn't cheap. And yet they're mesmerizing, aren't they? I keep thinking of some of the words Theodore Parker wrote near the end of his life. I have had great powers and have only half used them. There, at least in that one sentence, is where Parker was so much like the rest of us. We all have great powers that we have only half used. Isn't that one reason we come here? To keep being exhorted to develop the other half of our great powers and to use them. To use them to help ourselves and our world come more alive. We come seeking wholeness. To have illumination we need from these little lights of ours. And so often we don't want to admit that if only we will, we can have it.